side and said to him three words. And when Thomas came to his companion, they asked what had been said. Thomas replied, "If I tell you one of the words he said to me, you will bring stones to cast at me, and the fire will go forth from the stones and destroy you." The third one is, "Blessed is the lion which men will eat, that the lion may become man. And cursed is the man whom the lion will eat, that the lion will become man." And to Mr. Bly. We'll start with the first one. The middle one we might have to keep it a secret. It's a terrible one, really, in the implication. It says, "I will choose one from 1,000 and two from 10,000, and they will stand as a single one." Now, in all religious symbology of numbers, 1,000 means quite a lot. It's simply a very large number. In the primitive world, people counted up to 20 because they had 10 fingers and luckily 10 toes, and so they could count up to 20. And to count up to 100, they needed friends. And to count up to 1,000, they needed more friends than they had. And so 1,000 meant a quite high number. In fact, almost something beyond conception to the primitive mind. But it says, "I will choose one," and one symbolizes the unity of ritual itself. 1,000 means a great number, and one simply means what it says, the ground of unity. So we have to consider the meaning of one in relation to two, because the next part of the saying is, "and two from 10,000. Now two means duality or analysis. So we write one down for unity principle, and we write two down for duality principle. Now you know that duality signifies the idea side of your nature, the intellect, because the intellect actually functions by cutting things into two. So if we like to say that whatever the subject is, to look at it intellectually is to cut it and create a dichotomy. You know that when you use words to think serially, you have to make a subject and a predicate. And the predication cannot exhaust the subject without adding the subject in at the end of the predication. You say S equals P to the nth plus S in order to exhaust the subject. The subject is all that you may say about it by predication plus the subject, which is the unity prior to the analytical effort of the intellectual examination. So when it says I will choose two from 10,000, it is referring to the intellectual side of being. So we can write the word intellect on the side of the saying where two is mentioned, and ten, as you know, is from tenere to hold, and signifies ordinal perfection. 10 signifies ordinal perfection as opposed to 12, which is governmental perfection. You know, so 12 is 2 more than 10. 10 is an orderly system, and 12 is an orderly system plus the principle of duality or opposition above it. And any government sets up an ordinal system and then utilizes it over against the ordered. He said over against again. Over against the ordered being, so that in effect the orderly system can be used as a weapon against the people, and then the bureaucracy, that is the manipulators of the order, can be opposed by stirring up popular opinion. So that once you have set up an orderly system, you can proceed to annoy people with it. And then if the bureaucrats who are manipulating the system get too cheeky, you can always annoy them by stirring up the natural tendencies of people to hate order. So we see that I will choose two from 10,000. 1,000 means a great number, 10 means ordinal perfection, and therefore it means ideas. something to do with the intellect. I will choose 2 from 10,000. Therefore, the 1 signifies a feeling. So I will choose 1 from 1,000. Now we have a lot of feelings, a great number of feelings. Out of all these, we must choose 1. Now basically, feelings reduce to 2 feelings, liking and disliking. And the funny thing about disliking is that it is simply liking impeded. Disliking, like hate, is simply liking impeded. Hate is love impeded, and disliking is liking impeded. Because you never bother to dislike a thing unless it actually gets in your way, when you are trying to get hold of something you like. So the one feeling that is going to be chosen is positivity. I'm going to choose from 1,000 feelings, 1, namely positivity. That's the meaning of the name Jesus, the absolute positive. And we're going to choose 2 from 10,000, that is 2 ideas from a great number of ideas governing the orderly process of thought. Now the 2 ideas are the 2 horns of the paradox, or the 2 horns of the dilemma. Simply that all intellectual propositions, whatever, at their level of universal concept, admit of opposites. And therefore, if there is high, there is low. If there is near, there is far. And so on. So if we choose then positivity plus paradox, we have chosen 1 from 1,000 and 2 from 10,000. And we then turn them into 1. That is, we positively affirm the paradox. Now, paradox means beyond opinion. Dox means opinion. Para is beyond. So we affirm beyond opinion. We posit that beyond opinion is the supreme value. If we manage to do this, we will never be diverted by anybody offering us as a cure-all any one of a pair of concepts. If somebody comes along and solemnly assures us that there is anything other than absolute positivity affirming the paradox, if he says less than this, he's automatically wrong. If he selects one of a pair of opposites and proceeds to say this is the cause and cure of the universe, then he is at fault, because nothing can come into existence except by the self-opposition of power, and in this self-opposition is the paradox. Somehow Jupiter, God the Father, and Saturn, the devil, mutually presuppose each other. You cannot have this standing power, beyond the opinion. An opinion is a pin. You put yourself on the spot, you pin yourself down to some finite statement, one concept, and you pretend that this concept can solve the universal problem. If it is a concept at all, that is an idea representing a universal and abstract, it must have an opposite. If it has an opposite, the opposite is equally valid. So the first statement is relatively simple. I will choose 1 from 1,000 means the feeling of absolute positivity, and I will choose 2 from 10,000 means the 2 opposite concepts, and then these 2 will stand together as the simple whole apprehension of the positive paradox. Now we've said before that the absolute is a very peculiar thing, because it is a negation of a negation. If we remember, we used the paper to represent the absolute sentient power, and the motions of the paper constitute the world of actuality. Actuality is motion. And if we like to wave the paper about and then draw a line to represent the wave, we can draw lines in all different directions. And where they intersect, they are interfering with each other. And a zone of interference is a zone of the negation of the free motion. So that wherever we get a zone of interference, we bring into existence, by the proper meaning of the word existence, a finite entity which is essentially a self-contradicting negative structure. To exist is to be self-contradicting, because the forces inside that are making existence are opposing each other. So every finite existence is a zone of negation, where each force is busy negating the other forces. Remove all the forces except one, and that one will be an absolutely free motion, but it would not be an existential motion at all. Existence means existere, that is out of six, and implies a wheel. That wheel implies forces in opposition, because only forces in opposition can, by that opposition, create a rotating structure. The rotating structure is the finite entity, whether we're talking about a subatomic particle, like an electron, or an atom, or a molecule, or whatever it is. As long as we're talking about existence, we're talking about a structure made by powers opposing each other. And in the act of opposing, they are negating each other. So that existence is the realm of negation. Now, if we proceed to make a mark, then in the sign of the cross, to signify this positing of a finite, what it is actually positing is a negation. It posits a negation. If we then proceed to cross the thing off, we negate the positive negation, and thus we restate the absolute positive which preceded this negation. Every existence is a pressing in on the finite center, and in so doing is an abandonment of the absolutely free. The absolutely free is the sentient power of infinity. As it presses onto a center, by that simple contracting of its own field, it negates the free motion of power at that center, interferes with its own free action, and by this interference generates a wheel, and that wheel is an existential individual. But it is a negation. We have posited a negation when we bring to existence anything whatever. So as it is a negation, if we negate the negation, we get back the absolute positive with which we started. So when we say, I will choose one from a thousand, we choose one, which is the absolute positive, and that absolute positive negates the negation of the finite. In terms of a psychological exercise, it simply means you examine your individual self for possessiveness, the saturnine grip on the finite situation. And if you find any such grip on a finite situation, you deliberately let go of it. This is what Christ meant when he said, if you are prepared to lose your life, you will find it. If you try to preserve it, that is saturnine compression on the individual existence, as you're pressing on it, you are making it very conscious, sharply conscious of its limitations, and you are impeding the free circulation of energies within it, and as far as your organism is concerned, you are creating the preconditions of malfunctioning simply by hanging on to the being, or to anything the being is associated with, that it terms possessions or properties. We've said before in the Welsh language, you don't have a verb to have, you have another one, a verb to be with. Because, of course, Taffy was a Welshman, and Taffy was a thief means that the wicked Romans and others drove them out of the fertile valleys and chased them up into the barren hills, and there they hadn't got a lot to possess. So they gradually abandoned the idea of possession, of ownership, of property, and were content to use a verb to be with. It was sufficient to be with a horse. It didn't matter whose it was a moment ago, as long as you were riding it now. And the same with ladies, and consequently they kind of premarital courtship in Wales is normally more interesting than it is in England. So when we come to consider this, we take an expression like the Marxist expression, utility without possession. They're both rather Latinized words, and therefore they don't mean much to an English or Anglo-Saxon mind. Utility without possession sounds a bit venal. If we take exactly the same thing out of the Bhagavad Gita, it says, action without regard to the fruit of action. Same statement as the Marxist. In fact, Marx borrowed the idea. The idea of action without regard to the fruits is a very subtle idea, because in fact, we never act without regard to fruits unless we understand the meaning of the word regard. Regard means what it says, guard again. It's a defensive activity, regarding. The guard in guard means what it says, it just means guard. Set up some sort of obstacle so that nobody can come and get it. As usual, when an idea is translated by people that are merely scholars and have no experience of the reality underlying the expression, most European languages do not contain concepts of the kind required to translate an idea from Indian or Chinese philosophy. Consequently, action without regard to the fruits of action is not really a very good expression, because it suggests that you can act in a very peculiar way as if it doesn't matter what you do. Now, again, this is careless talk, because when we say it doesn't matter, we normally mean that it does matter. If we remember that the mere fact that we say it doesn't matter means it is not important, it's an indication of the materialistic stress on Western civilization. If something's very important, we do not say it spirits to me, we say it matters to me, which indicates that our general Occidental stress on value, on importance, is in the material world. When we come to look at real values, we find all real values, as indicated in the word value itself, have to do with volition, they have to do with the will. There are no values other than those wills. So if it is said by Paul, love and do what you will, and whether you do action A or action B is of no importance other than this, that you will do it, then the question of morality, which is a question of social utility, is not raised. Love and do what you will means, using the word love as equivalent to the agape concept, that is, willing for the development of the potentialities of beings, if you are honestly, and it's terribly difficult to be honest about, if you are honestly willing for the development of beings, then whatever you do is right. It is extremely difficult to be honest about this, because of Welsh philosophy working mysteriously in the chemistry and interfering with the perceptive faculties. But where a person does, in fact, manage to will to work for the development of the potentialities of being, then whatever that being does is quite right. And he has absolute backing. It's true that he may have finite opposition and get nailed, but he does have the satisfaction of being able to lift his eyes to heaven and say, Father, why hast thou forsaken me? And as that is only a ritual gesture, he knows it's not really so terribly important. So, fairly simply, we say that to choose one from a thousand means to choose absolute positivity. There's no room for the negation. St. Paul says of Jesus, he is wholly yes, there is no no in him. And his name actually shows in the Hebrew that it means say yes even to no. The terminal letter of his name means no, and the front part means yes. It means affirm even the negation. This is the hardest job there is, because we all want to improve, and yet the only means whereby we can improve is the one thing we do not feel inclined to do. Because, in fact, inclination never goes towards the difficult. It is always in the line of least resistance. And therefore, we say that the only way to defeat the mass inertia of wrong direction is simply to examine oneself for inclination. And then, because it is inclination, stop it. And if we manage to do this, we become free. And if we don't manage to do it, we will remain bound. When we choose the one, the absolute positive, then obviously we can no longer identify with a finite, particular, individual pattern. And we also see that it is a negation, and we cross the negation off. And so in negating the negation, we posit the original positive, the absolute, that has its root prior to all existence whatever. It is an absolute beyond the concept of existence, but it is the only ultimately real. I'll leave the middle question out for the moment, because I doubt if we will be able to talk about it. We'll go to the last one. The last one says, "Blessed is the lion which men will eat, that the lion may become man, and cursed is the man whom the lion will eat, that the lion will become man." Now, if we look in some ancient sources, we will find time represented as a lion, and we will find this statement in the Bible, "The devil goeth about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." What it means is the same thing that it says in Troilus and Cressida. The lion here symbolizes what is there symbolized by the wolf, the universal appetite. Which is a very great mystery, because if we say this white paper symbolizes the spirit, when the spirit moves, it moves because it moves. Nothing constrains it. It is its own will to move that moves it. There is nothing other than it, and therefore it is not reacting to an external stimulus. It is simply initiating movement itself. And as such, it is the absolute cause of all motion whatever. When we examine motion in ourselves, we invariably find at its deepest root, it quite simply comes down to an urge or will to move. And this is under the heading appetite, which in Troilus and Cressida is the wolf, and in this particular saying is the lion. Just as time brings things to be and devours them, so this lion is the absolute that brings to be the time itself. It creates time as a serial ensphering of forces, and then it proceeds to eat time and all its products. Now, blessed is the lion which men will eat, that the lion may become man. This means, if a man can understand this idea of the absolute appetite, the absolute appetite of the lion, the same one that Samson slew, he can constrain that appetite of the absolute to evolve into man, subject to man. And so that absolute appetite will gain in man, in the individual man who can do it, it will gain an awareness of itself as an absolute drive or appetite. And in so doing, man means to evaluate. It will evaluate itself in the man who will eat that lion. But if the lion eats the man, and not the man the lion, it means if this universal appetite gets into a man, and instead of him evaluating it, it proceeds to eat him, so that he's, as we say, eaten up with ambition, then certainly that man is cursed, because the appetite will become the man. That is to say, the man will be completely swallowed by the appetite. We will say it again. Blessed is the lion which men will eat, that the lion may become man. Here the man has the initiative. He gets hold of the appetite in himself, and he proceeds to eat himself and to evaluate this drive in himself. He has the initiative. The man is aware of the process, and he knows that this appetite is an absolute, and he knows that it is trying to eat up the whole of reality, and he knows that it will eat him unless he brings himself to eat it. But if the appetite gets hold of the man so that he can't control it, and then proceeds through him to try to eat up the world through him, He becomes a mechanism of absolute appetite and goes about eating things up. And in the process, he is not reflexively self-conscious. He is simply a doorway for a non-individuated appetite. He now has not got the initiative. He is entirely subject to that appetite. Some of the more pessimistic philosophers have thought that the first part of this saying is a definition of man, and the second part of this saying is a definition of woman. But there has been some considerable disagreement about this for the last 6,000 years. Certain it is that if a man allows the appetite to rule him instead of him constraining the appetite, it will destroy him. It will eat him up. Whereas if he can get hold of this primary drive in himself, this appetite, and he can curb the appetite, turn it round, curb it, and cause it to reflect on itself about its ultimate purpose, then he turns this absolute appetite by internal function into form. Remember, form is crystallized function, and function is simply the behavior of power. So as a man becomes embodied and formally by the way he allows himself to function, and the way he allows himself to function is the way his appetite has been allowed to go. If the appetite can get hold of itself reflexively, it will not destroy its own vehicle. And if the appetite cannot get hold of itself, it will actually consume the body that it is trying to use as a vehicle. In the riddle of Samson with the lion, it says, out of the eater came forth meat, out of the strength sweetness. The offered solution in the Bible is just a leg pull. It has nothing to do with bees coming, unless bees mean work. Certainly, the work that is done inside the dead appetite, the dead for Christ's sake, the appetite that has been mortified by self-control, the bees working in that can produce the sweetness of strength. There is no real sweetness except in a strong person, psychologically strong person, because a weak person is always invariably, I mean psychologically weak, not physically, a psychologically weak person is envious and covetous, and to that much less sweet than they might be. Out of the eater comes forth meat. The eater is the absolute appetite. The meat is the substance, and substance is simply the involving of that appetite, rotating, and the generating of a sphere in the rotation. That is me at the objective form of I, me, crucified in this place. So the absolute appetite, the absolute will of the Godhead, is coming in to make a universe, and the big ball that it makes is the Logos. The eating of this is the entry into it, and the process of digestion, or cutting it to smaller and smaller bits, in order to restate the continuum of power from which it was precipitated. So there's a cycle of power, involution, matter, digestion, back to power. This is the eater, the absolute eater, making itself one meat ball, and then proceeding to chew it up and restate its original condition of pure power. In fact, all the food we eat is simply crystallized power. The reason we eat it is to break its crystalline structure and regain it as power, and this we call the digestive process. So blessed is the man who can eat the lion, and cursed is the man who cannot eat the lion, but whom the lion eats. Now we'll have to waffle around the middle one, because it's not fair to say it openly, because we haven't got too many stones here to turn into fire. And he took him aside, that is, Christ took Thomas aside, and said to him three words. And when Thomas came to his companions, and they asked what had been said, Thomas replied, "If I tell you one of the words you said to me, you will bring stones to cast at me, and the fire will go forth from the stones and destroy you. Now again, we're up against a statement that has more than one level. At the lowest level, it says, if I tell you what Christ told me, you will be very, very annoyed. You'll be so annoyed that you will want to kill me. And you will take up the material world in order to kill me, and it's the stone world, and you'll start throwing material things at me, and the material situation will turn in such a way that fire, primary energy, will break out of it and destroy. In other words, the ground of their reaction to these words is based on this. They see the truth of what he says. He says something very mysterious here. Christ has said to him three words, and these words are so powerful that when they hear them, they understand that they are true. But because they're true, they must throw stones. Why? Because they didn't get hold of those three words. Now, if we say there's one word for each part of the threefold man, there must be a word relating to an idea, a word relating to the affective state of feeling, a word relating to cognition. In other words, there is an idea which, if everybody knew it, they wouldn't be doing what they are doing. There is a feeling which they got, if they got hold of it, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing, and there is a drive which, if they became aware of it, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing, but they would be busy, very busy, in destroying anybody who tried to stop them being what they were. Here is the doctrine of absolute power. Now, we can't actually go outside and tell everybody in the street what this means, because it means that when people talk about ideas, that is, they have a philosophical system, a worldview, they don't know what they're talking about, assuming they have got a philosophy at all. It's piffle. Also, it says that their affective life, that is, their emotional relation with other beings, which is the ground of their social relations, is also piffle and isn't worth a moment's serious attention. And also, what they think is cognitive drive is not any such thing. What they feel to be power in themselves is really powerlessness. It is trapped, grooved energy that has been put into grooves by tradition, but it was put there on purpose by some men who knew the ropes, and that it is still in the groove. We can't actually say more than a hint at this point, because if we say more than a hint, owing to the law of the inequality of finite existence, no two people are going to be at the same level in relating to this idea. And they might be on the edge of it in such a way that they would become very, very annoyed. I don't mean specifically with me as a person. Very, very annoyed that they had not known this, considering they have always known it. They knew it when they were born. They functioned on it when they were born. When the baby was extruded from the mother, it did three things simultaneously. And those three things show that the baby knows exactly what Christ is saying to Thomas. And immediately the parents go to work on it. And they are determined to destroy this inherent knowledge that the baby has. The baby has a very clear idea of where the milk is. The baby has a very clear feeling of whether it wants it or not. And the baby has a very strong drive to get it. And these three in the baby are not analyzed out. They function together, but they do not function reflexively. That is, the baby is not aware that it has these three functions. It is not aware that, in fact, it is already equipped with all it needs to go through life and fulfill itself. Because it is not reflexively aware, it can be robbed of this awareness. and the educational system is a method of robbing it. First thing the baby learns quite early on is that mother too has a will. Only mother's will was curbed long ago and is very distorted and does not have full awareness of why it is upset, why it is not happy, and so on. But because of this lack of awareness, it is determined, if possible, to restrict the free expression threefold of the life in the child. So very, very quickly, forces from outside impose on the child, and the child begins, although very reluctantly and with very, very great resistance at first, begins to accept a totally erroneous worldview. It accepts pseudo-philosophy, pseudo-morality, and it accepts breaks on its will. And it accepts these because it is not reflexively self-conscious. And because it is not, therefore, it should be imposed on. Because if it is not imposed on, it will never try to get reflexive self-consciousness. It will simply go on without it, functioning on its three levels, without any awareness that it is functioning on the three levels, and certainly without any of that mysterious entity called a package of consideration for others. It will assume, if it does not get thwarted, that the world is an oyster for itself to open. Now, actually, of course, the world is, but there are a lot of other oysters about the place. An oyster opens. The child does not know this. Now, yoga aims to restate, to reconfer upon a being this lost state which is called innocence. Innocence means, of course, innocuousness. It means one is not poisonous. And the child, no matter what it does, whether it stamps on your favourite toe or screams the place down for a lie, is not being innocuous at all. Not being noxious. Not being noxious. It is, in fact, just doing what it wants to do when it wants to do it. It's like the type of Viennese teenager. It wants what it wants when it wants it. And this is the mysterious rule. This rule is hinted at in the saying. Christ says something to Thomas, "You stuck your finger in the holes in my hand, and because you did this, I will tell you three words. One word for your hand, and one word for your heart, and one word for the belly." In the Ku Klux Klan in America, where you find the KKK symbolizing the same thing, cool, calm, and collected. And one end of the body has to be cool, the other end must be collected, and the middle part must be calm. Now, if one can gain this threefold balance, which is gained by reflexive process, becoming self-aware, then it is absolutely permissible to do anything whatever. Then why didn't Christ tell this to all the disciples? Well, if we read the Bible carefully, we can see that most of them hadn't got the faintest idea what he was talking about. We know the particular case of a couple of them walking by the side of Christ, by the side of God on earth, God incarnate, and they're arguing about who is going to have the seats in heaven next to him. Now that kind of argument in his presence shows their level. Now he's chosen 12 people for his own inscrutable purpose. He has not chosen what would have been called in those days the best educated and most eligible young men for the kind of propaganda job that he wanted to do. He's chosen some very simple fellows. He's chosen them simple because if they're simple, out of sheer economy, it will save having to do a job of brainwashing. He will simply put into their minds the ideas he wants to insert into their minds and know that these ideas must be like the leaven, which leavens the whole lump, because they have so little mental furniture, so little critical ability. These ideas will make their own way in the substance of the minds of these men. These men do not know the meaning of these words. It isn't necessary for them to know the meaning of it. It is merely necessary for them to repeat them. It doesn't matter whether they understand them. If they repeat them, other people will hear about them. But the ideas themselves are packets of formal energy. And these forms must logically work themselves out in the minds of the disciples, if they've been long enough, in the minds of any people who hear those words. Those words are the sound equivalent of concepts which are, in fact, formalizing energies. Once those words have been put in, then the idea equivalent is in, and the ideas begin to work. And the more simple-minded the person in whom they work, the more quickly they work. They have less rubbish to move out of the way. And so, Christ does not tell these who have not put their finger in the hole the mysterious three words that he does tell to Thomas. And he tells Thomas something which, if he were to tell to the others prematurely, they would most certainly be very annoyed, because they would demonstrate to them, first of all, that they had totally misconceived the function of the Messiah. Second, that they were not going to get that for which they had joined. You may know Ambrose Bierce's definition of an adherent. And he defines an adherent as a man who has not yet got that for which he came. Now, those disciples, if they knew the fact, as it did not correspond with the thing for which they joined, they would have been very annoyed, because they had already undergone quite considerable hardships and trampling about the country. They had less, however, than fairly reliable jobs, and here they were stuck in the middle of a concept about which they knew nothing. And because they knew nothing about it, they thought that this was what they wanted. And they thought that somehow it would mysteriously give them, as individuals, that for which they joined. But if he had told them that for which they had joined was so petty and so utterly stupid that they would have to abandon it absolutely, they would have been terribly upset. And if Thomas had told them, they would have just picked up the stones and bounced him with them. And of course, then, their inner perception of the truth, because they would have known immediately he said it, that their own cupidity had caused them to get in on this lark, and in the process of getting in on it, they had been blinded by the lion. They had been eaten by the lion. They had not eaten the lion had eaten them. And they would suddenly see that the whole of their private purposes, the reason for which they followed him, was doomed to inevitable defeat. And therefore he says to them this thing, that whatever Christ said was terribly mysterious. We can repeat it in various ways. The safest way to say it is this: if you have at heart the absolute benefit and the will to develop the full potentialities of all beings in the universe, then it is quite permissible in the light of that will to do whatever that will says you should do at the moment. And there is no other rule. But if you can't get hold of that, you will prefer, for security's sake, another rule, a lower rule. But if you prefer a lower rule, you are not going to like the men who take the higher one. You're going to be in the position of the silver man who hated the gold men. The gold men were acting by will, by spontaneous, centralized impulse. Not reaction, power from within, deciding from within without reaction that it would do X, X. And because this power is creative, it cannot be predicted. Because it cannot be predicted, then men at the silver level, the thinking, the adding up level, cannot comprehend what the gold men are talking about. And because they don't comprehend what they're talking about, they feel very insecure, and the next thing is they try to tie them up. And so we get the gradual silence of the gold men, the talking of the silver men. Silence is golden, and speech is silver. The gold men had to become quiet, because if they actually voiced their position, all the silver men would get together and proceed to kick them to death. So, as we said in the first place, the particular saying about Thomas is this: we cannot say openly the three words. There are three words, one to do with thinking, one to do with feeling, one to do with the primary drive, radiational, affective, and cognitive word. There are three words. These three words, understood properly within their proper definition, are a rule to end all rules. In fact, a taboo against taboo. But they obviously can only be assimilated by a person who is actually willing to be free with all the responsibilities that being free confers. And the person taking over that position has to assume full responsibility for whatever happens to himself. No matter how badly other people may behave when he does something, he has to affirm that they will behave in the way they do behave, precisely because he is such a being as he is. And he will say, the price that I pay is worth it. But if he cannot say this, then he should not be told, because it will merely focus his envy, sharpen his critical faculties, and make it extremely difficult for gold men to get on with the modicum of work that they already do. Have we anything to say about that? Question?
This would have a connection with the secret name in the old mentioned once a year by the factory. Would this be a connection now?
Well, as a matter of fact, we have exactly the three ideas expressed. If we take the literal significance of the three letters, at which end of the volume we place the I and which end the S? You know where the H will go, we'll go in the middle. Now, does this one belong at the head end? The serpentine subtlety? Is the punctiliousness there simply one spermatic energy packet, a quantum of primary life force? Or is it that the ideas are particularized, and there is nothing more subtle than sexual direction? The fact is that the universe is polarized. In the peculiar little symbol that we use, in the outline definition of its meaning, there is a statement of the relation of man to woman. This statement, thoroughly worked upon, will give the meaning of those three letters, which actually are the initial letters of the three missing words. If these three words are got hold of, nobody will ever be able to deceive you again, ever. Neither will you deceive yourself. But you will become absolutely responsible for whatever happens. There can be no conceivable excuse for one's own activity. There can be no possible justification for a complaint if the world comes and begins to throw stones. This is a question of absolute awareness equals absolute responsibility. It obviously has quite a lot to do with clarity of ideas. If you're not absolutely clear about the nature of an idea, if an idea is in fact circumscribed, and because it is circumscribed, you can throw it away. Because it is circumscribed. So as for ideas, you don't need any. As for the subtlety of the serpent, that happens to be the primary motion of the absolute, which is absolutely indestructible. From the individual standpoint, you don't need to hang on to that either. So you can throw that away. It will be there. And then straight away, you can represent the middle age, if you like, with one straight leg and one bent one. Tie on that. And bent one should be on the sinister side of the letter. And then you see that spiritual power has polarized itself as undulations and rotations. And the undulations have a way through the female. And the rotations have a way through the male. This is very near the same what these words are. He says you can talk to a man in terms of ideas. You should never talk to a woman in terms of ideas unless their ideas are charged with no idea. In other words, if you use an idea in talking to a woman, it should be so charged that it transcends itself absolutely and becomes particularly meaningless. But in the charge around it, because they are field aware in a way that a male is not, they can get what they would accept as the meaning of it, although by the meaning of the word meaning they would mean nothing. But it would nevertheless be sentience itself, power, and because it undulates, it has a very peculiar effect. But it will not have this effect on a male. But every human being is a hermaphrodite. If he is lucky and got himself so polarized that he knows that fact, thoroughly consciously, you can do nothing whatever with him. Because if you present your subtle S, he replies with a sharp eye. And if you look at him with a sharp eye, he presents you with a subtle S. Because he knows the rules. In effect, it says, it is your absolute duty to develop yourself, using capital S, in the place where you are, first, and middle, and last. And if there are any other beings about the place, in a particularized finite sense, if they happen to be of like mind, then it is permissible to communicate with them. But the communication can only be, as St. Paul says, in heaven. That is to say, in the inexpressible power field. One can feel immediately, in the slightest bit of practice, when a yes or a no would result from a question put. And because one can feel this, there is no necessity to put the question. If one cannot feel this, then the question is a waste of time, because it will require another question to verify it, and you'll have an infinite regression. Now I think we'll leave this middle question in this form, that we know that what Christ told Thomas in the three words was something to do with the ideational process, something to do with the emotional level, and something to do with the conative drive. That he told him three words. We could make colloquial expressions for these, which most lads in an engineering shop would recognize immediately, and they invariably cause overheating and irritability and reaction. These three words, these three concepts expressible in three words, are in fact very, very potent. To know these three words is obviously not to say them as from particular to particular unless the other particular already knows them. It is a secret that must never be communicated until it becomes unnecessary to communicate. But one can feel when it is about time that somebody is nearly going to voice it. And then one may give the sign of half a karate sitting on the lotus leaf, hold one's thumb to one's lips, and he will understand immediately. And then, if you wish, you could say it.
When you say the idea of poetry, if you mention these three words now, if they were mentioned at all, they can only be understood by subjectively. So, how are they so potent?
Well, they're so potent because as soon as they are stated, they are recognized as true, and a terrible heat rises inside, which is the product of the sudden awareness that one always knew these things and has been grossly deceived by education and made to abandon that which one knew was perfectly true. And one feels terribly resentful about this. In other words, every time you've been thwarted since you were a baby demanding to be fed, these thwartings have added up to bands of energy inside, restraining the psyche. These three words tell you something you already know, which you have been led to let go of. And as you hear them, the truth of them says, I knew it. I was grossly deceived by my dear mama and my even dearer papa, and I have been duped all these years. And that comes out tremendous energy. Now, on one occasion, there was a political gathering, and it involved a lot of people of various colours, Indians, Negroes, some whites, and so on. One of these was a lawyer, a Negro, and he started talking to me about the implications of something that had emerged, and he made a statement to me and asked me for a direct statement, yes or no. I will not say about which particular body he was talking about, because it's a very widely spread body. And I said to this, no. He immediately flew into a dreadful rage. He spun round, he didn't know where to look, he couldn't speak. He ran around physically in circles, came back and looked at me like a wild animal. He was not annoyed at me. He was annoyed that he had allowed himself to be duped long ago when he knew what he knew was true. Somebody had come along and told him another story and had diverted him from his primary life and had imposed upon him certain concepts, certain ritual forms of behavior, had destroyed his own integrity and inserted into him a behavior pattern utterly alien. And for 25 years he had devoted himself to this pattern, and always he had felt uncomfortable about it, but he had this feeling of discomfort repressed by kindly advice from well-intentioned missionaries and by mechanical processes within himself that said, you must accept this, because if you don't, you'll be sticking your neck out. Consequently, he found at the end that he had in fact been duped, and then all the energy that had been repressing his truth twirled round and became sheer rage, impotent rage. He could not speak. He ran about in circles. He might have hit me. He didn't. Something inhibited even that. The ordinary reaction in a case like that is to hit straight at the mouth of the person speaking, because it's out of that mouth that that word is coming, which says, you were self-duped in the first place, because you let go of what you had in order to get hold of something else that appeared to you at the time to be more valuable than that which you had when you knew that what you had was the highest value. You allowed yourself to be talked out of your inheritance. Jacob has cheated Esau.